From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 62 for Friday, the 10th of February, 2012. On the show this week, an 83-year-old lady gets a new lower jaw produced on a 3D printer. Generally, we mean, not live on the show, because that'd be weird. A British firm has built a 32 megajoule electromagnetic railgun for the US Navy. And how do you feel about kissing an overseas lover using a pair of networked electronic lips fashioned into the shape of a small plastic pig? We'll find out later, as all that and more is coming up. Ahoy! Ahoy indeed, Duncan. And of course, hoy. I'm Nate Langston, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me is the aforementioned provider of the first ahoy, Duncan Gear, news
Hello.
Editor extraordinaire, and Hello. Olivia Solon. Olivia
Hello.
_ Solon,
yes,
our associate
exactly.
editor. It's quite a lot of talking over each other for the intro. We don't normally do that.
Should we do it again?
Nah, it's fine. Everyone's in a good mood today because we're all high on cake. Been eating a lot of cake in the office.
I didn't have any cake.
I
just had
any
jelly.
Cake either.
It's actually a shame we're not wearing the party hats. The show would be better if we wore hats.
Yeah, we couldn't have worn the headphones, could we?
Very, very true.
Could have worn the party hats on our chests.
Thanks, Liv. But later on, we've got a feature from the Connecticut Art Fair. Katie will take us for an audible tour around the London Connecticut Art Convention. Connecticut is dedicated solely to kinetic, robotic, audible, and light and time-based art. And we went for a wander around to find out some weird... But the weirdest and coolest things on the show are there, and that's coming up in a bit. But first, the Twitter joke trial is going to the High Court. Duncan, you have been following this.
I have been following this. This is a chap called Paul Chambers, who very, very famously, you will probably remember this, tweeted way back, I think it was in 2010 or something, that, crap, Robin Hood Airport is closed. You've got a week and a bit to get your shit together, otherwise I'm blowing this airport sky high. Mm. And he was promptly arrested and accused of making a bomb threat.
Which, in a sense, I can understand, but it's kind of symptomatic of our paranoia of... airport violence, I think, more than anything else. It was obviously a joke.
Yeah, and he was handed out a fine of £1,000, and he appealed that. But after his first appeal at Doncaster Crown Court, that was raised to £2,600. So now he's taken it to the High Court in London.
And I remember at one point, Stephen Fry, I think, stepped in to offer to pay this guy's fine, didn't he?
I think lots and lots of people have offered to pay the fines off. But I think it's very much the principle at stake here. His legal team argue that his conviction is breaching his rights to free expression on the web, and that's quite a powerful argument, so yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the court takes that. What's important here is it's really the first case on what constitutes a kind of menacing communication over the internet, and it's going to set, you know, a precedent for the future. So it's very important that the High Court rules sensibly.
Hang on, surely it's linked to the riot Facebook messages, the two guys who got arrested for threatening to organise riots, but then they didn't.
But I think in those cases, there was clearly an intention that they were going to organise a riot, whereas in this case, it was a pure joke. To anybody yeah. that read that. His intended audience, certainly, who read that, would have definitely not have thought that he actually was going to plant a bomb in Robin Hood Airport.
Well, we'll follow the story up once it hits the High Court and keep you updated as to how that develops. A grandma, well, I say a grandma, I don't know if she's a grandma, she's 83 years old, so she's certainly a candidate for grandmarism. Belgian and Dutch doctors have replaced her badly infected lower jaw with a 3D printed replacement. The lower jaw of this lady needed to be removed, which would normally affect vital functions like breathing and speaking, chewing, swallowing, obviously. And given her age, it was seen to be too risky for the very tricky reconstructive surgery that would have been needed. Instead, a tailor-made implant was made from a type of powdered titanium printed layer by layer on a 3D printer. We've got a photograph of it on the site. I do recommend checking it out. But it's
before it was implanted, not after.
Oh, yes. Yeah, before.
My first thought was, man, she's going to be able to take a good punch now. Actually, hang on, maybe not. That's probably not appropriate.
I think more realistically is that it's another example of 3D printing being used in, you know, actual proper medical procedures. Yeah. I mean, we've seen it done with things like earpieces in hearing aids because it's such a... Those components are so small and so delicate, and quite often the parts to replace them are incredibly hard to find, that they can print replacements with using 3D printing technologies. But this is huge. I mean, relatively speaking, this is huge.
So what's the company that printed this, and how did it kind of work? How do they stop it from being rejected by the body?
Well, it's a company called Layerwise, and what they do, once they fuse these particles together, it was given kind of a bioceramic coating that was actually compatible with the lady's own tissue.
Okay.
That meant that the jaw wouldn't reject it. It wasn't going to be risking, you know, falling off, and actually has given her, well, I guess, a new lease of chewing life. obviously, teeth can be attached to it on the top. Pretty amazing.
That is awesome.
Definitely.
Next up, pew, pew, pew. Electromagnetic railguns, Duncan.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been producing some, I hear.
Yeah, BAE Systems has built an electromagnetic railgun, a 32 megajoule electromagnetic railgun for the US Navy to shoot at things.
Okay, before we get into actually this, what is a railgun? Because when I hear railguns, I think of those wicked weapons in Quake 3. That do go pew pew pew. I'm assuming these ones don't quite so much.
I don't know what noise they make. Okay. But what a railgun is it's a way of using electromagnetic fields to propel a projectile. So instead of like in a regular gun where you create an explosion behind the projectile and use that to propel it through the barrel is sort of charged up, and then it's like the magnetic field is shifted so that it's expelled at enormous forces out into wherever it's going.
So you say this is 32 megajoules.
Yes.
Now,
yeah.
How much is a megajoule? I mean, to me, that means nothing.
A megajoule is kind of about the same energy as a car traveling at 100 miles an hour.
And hitting someone or hitting something.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. I mean, joules are sort of, you know, they can be, energy can be potential, so it can be just traveling. But yeah, so it's kind of the equivalent of, I don't know, a car traveling at 3,200 miles an hour hitting you in the face.
Or 32
cars. Traveling at 100 miles an hour hitting you in the face. Either way, you don't want to be hit in the face by this.
No, and this has been built for the US Navy for cruise ships, I think.
Yeah, that's right. They asked several companies, BAE Systems being one of them, to build them prototype railguns, and BAE's is the first to be delivered, and they're going to test it now. So far, I think on the trials they've done so far, they've been able to accelerate a conductor to launch at about 7,200 kilometers an hour. Which is pretty fast.
You definitely don't want to be hit with one of those.
Sorry, Nate, no. Did you say they're going to use it on cruise ships?
Yeah, well,
as in like
no,
for like
cruisers, I think he meant.
I think kind of cruise missiles from a ship.
Oh right, yeah, I was going to say that was yeah. Like, quite extreme defense system for a cruise ship.
Well, it's dangerous out there.
It's,
you know, smarly pirates.
You're
don't
sailing
want
to... in uncharted territory sometimes. Yeah. Well, probably never actually, but
So this the eventual goal is to have a gun that can shoot between 50 and 100 nautical miles. Which would make it kind of good for naval surface fire support and land strikes and ballistic missile defences and stuff like that.
Could give a new lease of life to human cannonballs.
Could do. You'd be a sort of human rail instead, though.
You'd still be the ball, just projected by the rail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
I think there may be some health and safety issue there.
I suspect there might be some leg pain caused something like that.
Don't try this one at home.
You know, the history of the human cannonball is actually quite fascinating. It's a very family-based thing. You know, you get passed down through the same family, and it's, you know, generally families that produce human cannonballs. Anyway. Okay. I think if you were fired out of a cannon, though, at 7,000 kilometres an hour, you probably want a glass of wine when you hit the earth and live. You've been writing about a pretty interesting type of wine.
I have, yeah. I've a guy called Ian Hutchin, who's a British guy living out in Chile, has merged two of his favourite hobbies, which are winemaking and astronomy, to create a wine that has been aged in an oak barrel along with a 4.5-billion-year-old meteorite. And the wine is called Meteorito.
Of course it is.
Now, this is a Cabernet Sauvignon grapes that have been placed into the barrel with the meteorite that crashed into the Atacama Desert 6,000 years ago.
Now, a meteorite originates, basically an object that originates from space, but that means they could taste of quite a few things. What does he say this tastes of?
He says that it tastes a bit like space. He says it will give people the chance.
It tastes of space.
Yeah, no, listen to this. He says, I want to give people the chance to touch an element of space and taste particles of the birth of the solar system via a very good handcrafted wine. However, most people would argue that given that meteorites are made largely from iron nickel, that they're probably more likely to taste of kind of rust from the iron content.
Yeah. The thing is that he's missing is that everything in the world came from space. We're made from the explosion of a star.
And how does this work? He just dumps the meteorite in the barrel and leaves it there for a bit.
Yeah, well,
couldn't you just do that with some rusty nails?
Possibly, and it, you know, maybe we
have.
It's
not as romantic, though. I mean, Valentine's Day coming up. I mean, if I didn't go to a girl and say, hey, I've bought you this bottle of wine.
Yeah.
It's aged with a meteorite. She'd say, oh, how lovely. You know I like space and old things. Then another guy comes up behind trying to steal your thunder and says, hey, lady, I've aged this wine with a nail.
Yeah.
Which one are you going to take
home? Rusty nails.
Yeah, I think it's a nice story, and it's this is his passion, space. Mm. And what he does, he serves this wine at his astronomy center in the middle of the desert. So you can look up at the sky and enjoy the wine and kind of revel in the fusion of, like, the delicious space wine and the actual space above you.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. I really, really want him to send us some.
Okay.
I think we should buy some. We should try and, you know, pay for it to come over here and try some on the show.
We could have a wine tasting on the podcast.
Yeah.
Can
we do that?
That'd be good.
That'd be great. We should do that. Well, while we plan that, we're going to take a quick ad break. But when we come back, sad news, Alan Turing is not getting a pardon.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
A petition calling for Alan Turing to be pardoned has been declined by our government, despite collecting over 20,000 signatures. Turing, obviously, is best known for his role in formalising computer science, or the basics thereof, and worked on cracking German encryption at Bletchley Park during the Second World War. But he was gay, and in 1952, he admitted that he had been in a homosexual relationship with another man and was subjected to chemical castration, was stripped of his professional roles, and he committed suicide 2 years later. And that's no secret, but a petition was calling for that to be pardoned, given the fact that, quite rightly, that is no longer illegal these days. Sad news, or not?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. In 2009, there was a big petition on this subject to issue an apology to Turing and his family on behalf of the British government for the treatment he received. And Gordon Brown did that. He said that his treatment was horrifying and utterly unfair. But a pardon is a little bit more difficult. And Lord McNally, who's the person that was sort of considering this in the House of Lords, kind of explained this. He was saying that a posthumous pardon isn't really kind of appropriate because Turing was convicted of what at the time was a criminal offence. He would have known that his behaviour was against the law at the time and that he would be prosecuted if he was caught. Now, that is no excuse for, you know, such a barbaric law in the first place. But it does kind of mean that if you pardon him, there's, you know, why just Turing? Why does he get special status and not every other person who, you know, was prosecuted under the same law?
And likewise, why that law and not every other law that we've since overturned? You know, witches used to be burnt at the stake, and so we need to go back and apologise to all those ladies
and their descendants, and yeah. And all of these things. And so that makes it quite difficult to do this. And what the government is doing right at the moment, there's a bill making its way through the House of Lords right now, is pardoning people who are still living who were convicted under this law. If that sort of goes through, and there's no reason why it won't, it will, you know, everybody who has a criminal record as a result of having been convicted for homosexual acts will be pardoned. But it's kind of difficult to do that posthumously.
Yeah, Lord McNally as well, he said, rather than trying to alter the historical context and to put right what cannot be put right, ensure instead that we never again return to those times. And I think the chap who originally called on the government to apologise for Turing's treatment in the 50s actually agreed with this and essentially said, you know, it should be everyone or no one, and picking out Turing, you know, because of his contributions to the war effort, for example, isn't fair on the people who were just regular people and who now have a criminal record for being gay in the 50s.
Yeah, that was John Graham Cumming who was behind the original petition. He said on his blog, even if a pardon is appropriate, a pardon for simply Turing would be unjust to the other gay men who suffered under the law. There were many others, and there are men alive today living in Britain with a criminal record because of these offences during the time laws were in force. He says, I could get behind a petition for a pardon for all those people, especially since living people are still being hurt by this law, but not just for Turing, and pardoning him doesn't help anyone living today.
If you have an opinion, drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk, or let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wiredUK. Really interested in hearing what people say. There have been people on the net who have said that this was wrong and that Turing should be pardoned because of how important his role was in, you know, in the
creating British... computer science and in, you know, fighting Germans in the Second World War.
Exactly. And for that, he should be given special treatment. But certainly what I've read, the majority of people seem to be, you know, it should be all pardoned or none. But let us know what you think. We've got one more story to get to in the news, and that is, well, the title here is Robot Kissing Pigs. Liv, it's something you wrote about that fascinated me despite its rather humorous photo.
Now, is this a robot kissing a pig?
No.
Is it a pig kissing a robot?
These are kissing pigs that are robotic.
Okay.
So these are, it's kind of like teledildonics for wimps.
Okay, what's a teledildonic?
It's a remote sex toy that you can interact with your lover over the internet with. Mm-hmm. And so what this is it's these spherical robots that look a bit, they look like kind of cartoon pigs. And they've got these enormous silicon lips on their faces. And what you can do is you can be talking to someone over the internet and decide that you want to kiss them. So you pick up your spherical pig toy and you press your lips against the pig's lips. And there are lots of pressure sensors in those lips that relay that information over the internet to the other a partner pig or whatever bunny creature that they've got at their end.
So the idea, I guess, as a real life example, my girlfriend was in Serbia for a week a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And every night we chatted on Skype for an hour or so. I guess that would have been a prime candidate to test out some of these robot pig lips.
Exactly. So you could just pick up your pig lips, give them a smooch.
But that's the thing. I don't think that's very attractive.
Can I just ask a question here? Why a pig?
I don't know. That's just the design. Yeah. They've been given this kind of friendly, unsexual design, I think, because of the idea that from the designer, who's called Human Samani from the National University of Singapore, was that they could be used just for kind of light affection between parents and children and not purely as a kind of sex toy, even if you could even call them a sex toy.
There was a guy a few years ago who invented a remote hugging body frame type thing where you could put on this, it looked a little bit like a big bulletproof vest, and somebody at the other end could squeeze I think like a similar unit, and the person wearing it at some other part in the world would be squeezed in the same notion, the idea that you could give someone a hug remotely. That wasn't quite as creepy as this.
No, but very similar thinking behind it.
Yeah, but what makes this creepier is this isn't just about a human kissing a human virtually. This could be human kissing a virtual character. And that's where it gets a little bit shady for me.
Well, that's when I started thinking about your weird wives of Skyrim, and I was thinking there's an opportunity for you here, Nate.
There is a guy from PC Gamer married to the same woman.
Oh, wow. You could all have a three-way kiss.
I hear the divorce bells. But why would you want to do that, though? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I'm a big gamer. Duncan, would you want to kiss a virtual character? Via a pig?
I think if it was artistically justified in the game, I'd probably have no problem. I'd feel weird maybe to do it to start with, but if it was kind of part of the game and it added something creatively and artistically to the experience, I can't see anything wrong with that.
Mm.
What if it was a pig in the game?
I would probably be less keen unless it was a really sexy pig.
Yeah.
It does give new meaning to lipstick on a pig.
It does, definitely does.
Well, if you'd like to kiss a virtual character via the medium of a plastic set of pig lips, do let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. That's why we bring these topics to you, to discuss them, to inflame your mind.
Maybe in a future wired.co.uk podcast, we could have one of these little things here.
Duncan, I'm not
kissing
you.
All the listeners.
Yeah, listeners could send us kisses during the show. If you want to kiss us, then detail your kiss, send it in an email, podcast@wired.co.uk.
I'm not sure I want to kiss
our
listeners.
We'll read your best kisses out.
But you'd be kissing the pig.
I don't want to kiss a pig. No, it's creepy. This is the whole thing. It's too creepy. It's too creepy. Well, it's time to move to another set of lips, Katie Scott specifically, and she has been exploring the wonderful world of the Connecticut Art Fair. Katie, the trinket cupboard, enjoys your presence. So you've been to something called Connecticut this week, which is something dedicated, according to the note you've given me, to kinetic, robotic, sound, light, and time-based art.
Indeed.
If you ask me, it sounds crazy.
It was slightly crazy, actually.
What's all this about?
It's basically an art fair, and it brings together artists from all over the world. And they have about 400 installations, I do believe. And it takes place in London, near Baker Street. And it runs until this Sunday, which is the 12th of February.
What makes this so relevant to Wired, though? It's not just a regular art gallery. You've seen some really weird stuff.
I have, and it's, well, I guess the relevance to Wired is the technology behind all these machines, and a lot of the installations are machines. They're not, you know, paintings sitting on a wall looking pretty. I saw everything from a carriage drawn by an ostrich-like creature with a hand for a head, to machines made from old vacuum cleaner tubes.
Okay, and there's something there, a special exhibition called The Art of Universal Knowledge, Time, Transformation and Energy. That got my eyebrows raised. What's that?
Well, the best person to explain it was Diane Harris from the Connecticut Museum, and she actually curated the exhibition.
Connecticut is very much about universal concepts, so it's artists harnessing the universal forces, which is very apt for now because, you know, we're very much into our existence, climate, planetary change, transformation. That's what the theme is this year.
And an installation that does just that is Mappings by Balint Boligo, and he's using centuries-old technology to do it.
It's kind of using the kind of almost the most basic forms of mechanical movement that we know, which is a body swinging in space and being affected by the world's mass, the gravitational pull. And here I'm using a single pendulum whose motions are harnessed with wires and pulleys and transferred onto a globe, onto a pen, which is transferring these movements and making a drawing on a rotating sphere. So essentially what we have here is the gravitational pull of the Earth making a drawing of itself.
Balint also had a work on show that uses lasers, but said that it actually produces very similar images to the pendulum. One artist, though, who just isn't interested in new technology is Pascal Bette. He creates these wonderful whirring installations from old machine parts and cites one of his influences as the work of Swiss artist Jean Tangli, whose museum in Basel I'd recommend anyone goes to.
I used to collect old motorcycles and I loved old mechanics from the 20th century beginning. And now I like to take old machines and tools, which are very ingenious, and today they are worth nothing. So my idea is to put them, to make new machines with them, a little crazy, and show those machines working again, but in another way.
And he's quite happy sticking with mechanical machines.
No, I'm still working with very old machine, you know, 1920 or pre-war machines, and this is what I like, and I'm not very fond of computers also.
Another artist using discarded machines is Alexander Bercher, whose work on show incorporated old vacuum machine tubes and bicycle wheels. Much like Bette, he sets out to give them a new lease of life.
An old Hoover that you would throw away, putting it together with different things, and people realize, oh, actually the creative potential of this object is enormous.
He says that digital technology is out of his reach, as it's not something he's trained in, but actually it doesn't bother him, as it's not the right tool for the work he creates.
I'm not gonna try to drive a nail into the wall with a saw, so I'm trying to use a hammer because this is what I can do. And I'm not a programmer, I'm a hands-on person. That's why I go for things that I think I can execute well, rather than jumping in the cold water.
For Balint, it's simply a case of resources. A lot of new technology is out of date before artists have the means to access it.
By the time artists get their hands on technology, their technology is already out of date. Unless you've got very deep pockets and stay in touch with kind of the most up-to-date research.
All awesome stuff, though. What stands out for you? What's the coolest thing, the weirdest thing? I want to know, if I go, I want to know what do I go to first?
Well, they're not necessarily weird, but I really, really love the lasers. I think just where they're placed in the exhibition in sort of darkened corners makes them really, really stand out. And in particular, I like the work of David Ogle and Andras Mengen. But what got me with Andras was talking to him afterwards, because he started talking about walking through walls and also the mystery liquid that he shines his lasers through. And he said that it's made from a secret recipe that he can't reveal.
My main aim is that how can a man go through a wall, a brick wall? So that's why I created this new invention. It's a laser installation or laser sculpture, may I call it, because I can pass through the light walls. So if you come, anybody here in the art, a kinetic art fair, you can see it. And if your dining room, now suit, you can swim in and it pass through the light walls. So it's what I present here is a three-dimensional laser animation. I invented this special liquid, which creates the two-dimensional image transform into 3D and create an entire new image for the observer or the visitors.
Ogle's work is far more site-specific, but behind it is often open-source software.
As well as these installation pieces, I do a bit of programming as well for some of my drawings, using some of these open-source kind of programming languages like processing and open frameworks, and that's really had an influence on these works as well.
Tech's been a running theme. What tech do you think the artists are getting excited about in the future?
Well, for Ogle, it was projectors and, of course, big and more powerful lasers.
Projection technology is becoming so small and compact and easy to kind of move around. These pieces, they kind of have the look of lasers, but lasers are becoming so much more readily available now. I'm thinking of large-scale kind of outdoor pieces involving powerful laser jets up into the air and stuff. So that's something I'm looking into at the moment, which hopefully will come about sooner or later.
Harris says it's a golden age for artists because of the vast array of tools they have access to. But for her, it's holography that she's excited about.
I think holography is actually going to take off, especially because this year we've got the Musion holographic system. And I feel that sort of live performance mixed with holography is still a very new realm.
And in fact, I caught a showing of The Siren by Laura Jean Healy, which is a hauntingly beautiful underwater hologram. Ultimately, though, Harris says it's not really about the technology artists decide to use, it's how innovative they are with it.
Well, I think a lot of artists are actually creating their own technologies. So what they're doing is they're using found or existing technologies and recreating it to please themselves in a way, or to put over what their message is. So that's what Connecticut's really about. It's about innovation, and it's about artists actually presenting new ideas and new ways of thinking.
Okay, I'm sold. I want to go and see it. When's it on? When's it end?
It's on now. It's on until the 12th of February, which is this Sunday. And if you want to get a bit of a preview of what you can expect, we've already got a gallery on the website, and we're also going to have a full show report.
This is good. This is what I like to hear. Katie, thanks for being in the Trinket Cupboard.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's the end of our show. It was a prompt and concise show, I felt. I felt we delivered meaning into the world of pig lips. I feel we expanded the minds of thousands.
Maximum value, minimum time.
Yeah. Isn't that right, Liv?
It was a powerful podcast.
Well, before I tell everyone they can hear the same thing again next week, why don't we tell them how they can get in touch? Olivia, what's our email address?
Our email address is podcast@wire.co.uk.
And maybe one day you'll be able to send us a kiss through that email address. But until then, we also have a Twitter account, which is, I think, twitter.com/wired.uk.
That's correct.
And facebook.com/wired.uk.
Right again. It's right. Like you work for Wired or something.
You know, I gave a talk the other day about our Facebook page and how it's kind of more like a fan club than a way of driving traffic. Because really, we just want to know who you are. We want to have conversations. Come and join it. We give away stuff sometimes. And, you know, Duncan posts pictures of when our ceiling falls down.
And then other people post pictures of me eating jelly. So that's unusual.
It's really an amazing...
You don't get jelly pictures on, you know, other Facebook pages.
You don't. And you're not going to get anything else from us until next week. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, lips move on to the feature.
Oh, God.